But yeah, it's definitely something that a lot of people do. And I think it's a little generational in that my older patients tend to not tell. They're kind of gatekeepers. Mm. They just kind of do it. And, you know, like they don't park under the giant sign. They kind of sneak in. And then the younger patients are going live on tick. It's like, I never thought I would see the day, but Botox has almost become cool.
Welcome to the Rich Summers Report, where we talk real estate, business, and wealth building, all while keeping it real. No fluff, no BS. I hope that you enjoy the show. All right, guys, welcome to another episode of The Report. Today, we are back in the studio and we got a little sunshine outside. It's starting to feel more and more like summer, which I'm super excited for, but I'm very excited for this guest today. He is the founder of SD Botox. I got my man, Dr. Alex Roher. Alex, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, man. Appreciate you coming on the show. I literally started my Botox journey a week ago. And I got to say, man, it's been a good experience so far. I didn't know much about it until the girls on my team were like literally doing a kind of like a Botox party, if you would. Mm-hmm. And they were all kind of doing it. And so I started learning more and more about it. And once I learned it was a little bit more preventative, like, you know what? Let's try it. Let's see what happens. I'm 38. I'm going to be 39 this year. And it's been great so far. So I'm excited to have this conversation with you. I have so many questions. I know there's a lot of, I see pros, cons out there on social media, online about Botox. Is it good? Is it bad? And some of the other stuff that's out there. I'm so excited for the conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. It's my first podcast. So
first one, man.
Yeah.
We're popping that podcast cherry. Okay. Yeah, man. So you founded SD Botox in 2013.
Yep.
How did that come to fruition?
Yeah, so I was an anesthesiologist, full-time anesthesiologist, working at Sharp and Scripps. And I just wanted something more, you know, I needed something. So I started a company called SD Botox and literally no one came in the door for a year, but it didn't bother me because I was, you know, I was an anesthesiologist, so I was happy. And then just kind of slowly started getting into the business side of it, learning, you know, I think most doctors are very risk adverse, I would say. They just don't. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons you go to med school is because like the challenging part is getting into med school. But once you're in, like everyone finishes, everyone gets in residency, everyone gets a job. They all make like 300,000 or 400,000 more a year, whatever. And so I just decided to roll the dice and start SD Botox as like a little side thing. And my little side hustle took off and then got busier and busier and ended up liking it more than anesthesia. So I haven't put anyone to sleep for, I think, 4 years at this point.
That's probably a good thing. So you mentioned that a lot of doctors are risk adverse, and I find that interesting, but it kind of makes sense because becoming a doctor comes with a lot of job security. So if you don't have a high risk tolerance, it's almost a way to kind of play it safe.
I agree.
And I never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
But no, it makes a lot of sense.
Like that's their personality. I don't know if you guys have a lot of doctors that invest in your funds, but
we do. Like my dentist up in La Jolla, he invests. And we have a surgeon who invests as well in our fund, but we don't have any anesthesiologists.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh,
wow. At least not yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, you mentioned a lot of doctors like, you know, they don't have a high risk tolerance. What was it about entrepreneurship that actually sparked your interest?
Yeah, I think it was the risk. You know, I think it was like, you know, when you're an anesthesiologist, you go to work and you do a good job and no one dies and you feel good about it and you go home and that's it. And it's like, there's no like long-term goals, you know, it's like you just repeat that every day.
You didn't feel like you were growing.
I didn't feel like I was growing. Yeah. And I didn't think I was feel like I was growing anything else. You know, SD Botox became my baby. And so it was like every day I would chip away and I would kind of figure some different piece of the business side out. I didn't get like an MBA, just kind of learned through trial and error, like A-B testing life. It just became like when my mind would go idle, I mean, I would never start thinking about SD Botox. I'm sorry, I would never start thinking about anesthesia. It was just like, you know, it was like the kind of thing where a lot of people have that job where you go to work and do a good job. And then you go home and you don't think about work until you go back to work. Whereas I think on the entrepreneur journey, I think you never turn it off and you're always thinking about it. When your mind goes idle, that's what you're thinking of. Mm-hmm. And so I just found myself more interested in, one, the aesthetics, like the Botox and the leather lasers and crazy stuff we do, but just the business side of it fascinated me and the marketing and like the all the things you have to do when you're a business owner.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm curious, how did you, because you mentioned the first year you had no business and then things started to turn around. How did you learn the business component of it? Because, you know, like myself, I was a real estate investor, but in real estate investing, it's like strategy, right? And then all of a sudden now you're growing a real business and there's a whole other component that has nothing to do with real estate strategy. that comes with running a business.
For sure.
The marketing, the leadership, all that other stuff that HR. Comes into it. How did you learn that?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't take a course. I just did it. You know, I think I was willing to be wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that's what separates people that are willing to start a business from people that aren't. You know, I think a lot of people want to, but they're not willing to take that first step. They're not willing to know that they can be wrong.
Yeah.
And they're not willing to have their income, let's say, go down before it goes up. So I think there's really something beautiful to people that are willing to take that chance. Like I'm sure you don't look back with regret at this point.
No. I mean, I make mistakes every single day, every week. We're pivoting so much. We're so fluid. But I think when I jumped in, you know, I was terrified to make a mistake. And I think most people are. But then in all reality, like all the mistakes that we compile is how we grow.
Totally. Right? Yeah.
So now the mistakes, just as we grow, the mistakes become bigger and the stakes are bigger. You're just playing with bigger poker chips
now,
right?
Yeah. The stakes are more painful nowadays, yes. For sure.
Yeah. So anyway, so you mentioned the first year was slow. What was the big turning point in your estimation?
I don't know. You know, it was just like Botox is a repeat business. And so, you know, as you'll find out on your Botox journey, it lasts anywhere from 3 to 4 months. And so that first crop of patients started coming back and telling their friends. In the early days, Yelp was really big for us. Hmm. Like, I don't think Yelp is kind of losing out to Google, I think, right now, as far as the reviews go, but we were just really highly ranked on Yelp. I think that's kind of how people started coming in. And then I figured out marketing and SEO and all the things that, you know, I don't know if you've driven around San Diego, but I've got giant SD Botox signs. I mean, like, I basically make them, max them out everywhere I can go. And I think just once you look at that sign, like everywhere you go, it's like, oh, I'll give it a try.
You do know? The billboards? Is that what you're talking about?
They're not billboards. They're just giant signs.
Okay.
You know, like in PB, in Pacific Beach, that office has a giant sign right on Grand Avenue, which is a major street. And then there's one.
I was in PB on Sunday this weekend and I looked over and I saw your shop right there. So yeah, you can't miss the signage.
No, it's like massive. You know, someone called it Botox for the blind. You know, it's like, it's in your face.
So now you got how many shops?
I have 6 in San Diego and 5 outside.
Dude, you're rocking and rolling, man.
Yeah.
I love that. You. So tell me like exactly what you guys provide as someone that comes into one of your shops.
We do a lot of Botox, obviously it's in the name, but there's 4 pillars in my world. There's injectables, which is Botox and dermal fillers. Dermal fillers are, you know, when you see someone with lips that are too big, it's a terrible example, but
that's
for every one of those, there's probably like 20 or 50 people that have done their lips and it looks good. But that's a dermal filler, things that make things bigger. And then there's laser and energy-based devices. So, you know, you could do different lasers if you have sun damage, if you have rosacea, if you have, you know, you're just getting old and skin laxity, whatever. We have laser and energy-based devices for those.
Hair removal, is that included with the laser?
Yep, we do laser hair removal. We do laser tattoo. We do...
Really? Tattoo removing?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, okay.
Tattoo's tough. Tattoo is like super painful and you always have kind of, it's not never like 100% gone. So the technology is getting better, but you've seen people that have removed tattoos and it's still like a smudge there. So it's great if you're going to remove the tattoo and do a cover up.
Yeah.
But if you want to go to like zero, I mean, you'll always have like a little shadow, a little outline.
Yeah. I have tattoos and I have a really good artist and she tells me like a lot of her patients, they come in with like tattoos that they got when they were 18 years old and they're like, they don't want them anymore. But a lot of these artists will say, hey, I can't cover that up. You got to get it removed. And she ends up getting these patients and she ends up just doing a cover up. They never have to get it removed. And the cover ups are great. And so I'm like, from a pain perspective, I hear the laser removal for a tattoo is like, pain is like 10 out of 10.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, you just go find a good artist and cover it up unless you're really just trying to remove it.
Yeah. She's unique. I mean, it's great. It's a testament to her as an artist if she can do a tattoo cover up without getting laser tattoo removal.
I've seen some crazy like before and afters, but that's why I use her.
She's probably, like, you know.
I've seen her work.
She sounds like she's a great tattoo artist and probably paying a premium for someone like that, for sure.
And when you do the removal, how many sessions is that?
Oh, anywhere from 8 to 12.
Dude, that's crazy. And how long is one session?
They're quick. So you're right. It is very painful, but...
What, 2 minutes?
2 minutes, yeah.
Oh, that's really quick.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So what was the fourth component?
So the two others are esthetician services. So, you know, like in my world, there's like doctors and nurses could do certain things like injectables and laser and all that stuff we talked about. Then the estheticians are peels and hydrofacials. You know, things that are therapeutic, but also sometimes just like just feels good to get a facial kind of stuff. And then finally, at-home medical-grade skincare. which is important too. I mean, like the big thing now everyone's putting on their skin is exosomes. So when stem cells divide, there's these little vesicles left in between. They're full of growth factors. And so they're able to purify them and put them in. We can inject them. We could put them in creams, all that kind of stuff. So at-home skincare is like the fourth pillar, I would say.
Okay, gotcha. So would you say the primary thing you guys do, though, is the Botox?
Yeah.
It is, okay.
For sure. We're heavy on the injectables.
Yeah. Sure. So I had my first session last week. It was in-home. Someone came over to my place. Christy Shaw, shout out to Christy, and did 84 units, forehead, around the eyes, in between the eyebrows. And dude, it was quick and easy. It was like five-minute thing.
Right.
And within 36 hours, I started to kind of notice the difference. And I would say now it's been a week. And I can't like make an expression on my forehead.
Exactly. So
it's kind of nice.
84 is a lot, which is good. I mean, it's not bad.
I told her I wanted the max for like the first
session. Like your style. You're like, first time.
Well, because she was telling me like, hey, like, you know, we can do this. And she goes, if it's not enough, I can come back in 2 or 3 weeks. And I'm like, I don't want you to come back. I want to just be good. So she's like, cool, we'll give you 84.
That's awesome. Yeah. So the goals are different for different areas, I would say. Okay. So like, this is called the frontalis, the horizontal lines on the forehead.
Okay.
And most patients, I could probably use some Botox now, so don't judge, but most patients, you know, they still want to raise their eyebrows.
Yeah.
It looks weird if you can't.
Yeah.
This is called the corrugator. This kind of like, you know, the angry 11 like this, and you're mean mugging someone. The goal is like completely freezing. Like in the history of Botox, no one's ever complained about being too frozen there.
Yeah.
Just you're happy. You can't furrow your brow anymore. Those lines fade.
Totally.
And then the third big one is the crow's feet. And so it's kind of in the middle. You want to, when you smile, you want some animation, obviously no thing to change in the mouth, but you want a little less motion right here. That's actually, I mean, it's an interesting story how Botox was, I wouldn't say invented, but how it came to be what it is today is because there are certain patients that were seeing their ophthalmologist for what's called blepharospasm. So it's like flickering of the eyelid. Kind of like if you ever get like, it's called a fasciculation, like a muscle in your body, just like kind of rapid fires.
Yes.
Some people have that chronically in their eyelid. So they were injecting Botox and then all these patients just did not have crow's feet anymore, minimize their crow's feet. So it was kind of serendipitous, but all of a sudden everyone was like, oh, I need that, even though I don't have blepharospasm. And then Allergan, the company that now owns Botox, who sold to AbbVie, but they noticed that there was this other purpose, the cosmetic side of it, bought that drug, rebranded it Botox Cosmetic. That was like in early 2000s and just, you know, they've done well since.
Got it. So she was telling me before we did the session, she said, hey, like when you smile, your eyebrow kind of comes, it's pulled down naturally. I think that happens to a lot of people. But she goes, if you want, I can do some extra here. And when you smile, it will keep your eyebrow up. And so I was like, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
And so I didn't even know that the Botox would actually change the complexion of your eyebrow when you smile.
For sure. So Botox is primarily used for wrinkle reduction. That's what everyone thinks. But you can target specific muscles to do certain things. So that's a very common one. If you think about the tail of the eyebrow, there's one muscle that pulls it up, and that is the frontalis. And then there's one muscle that pulls it down, which is the orbicularis.
Okay.
And so if you selectively paralyze the depressor and not the elevator, the muscle that pulls up will be unopposed. And so it will lift the tail of your eyebrow. And so it's great for men, but it's amazing for women. Women are always wanting more of a more open eye, more of an eyebrow arch, et cetera. It's gotten to the point where I used to ask, do you want me to raise your eyebrow? And unless it was very obvious that they had a very high arch, I mean, they would say yes, like 99 out of 100 per time. So I kind of just do it to everyone and they love it.
Why is it better for women?
I think just societal standards of beauty. I think, you know, men, we'd look a little better with a little flatter eyebrow, and women really want that kind of arch.
Dude, I had no idea that you could literally change the shape of your eyebrow and your smile and all that sort of thing through the Botox. Are there any other areas of the face where the Botox can actually change your look?
Yeah, so I'll just go over the areas of the face. Like you mentioned the big three, the frontalis, the corrugator, and the orbicularis for the horizontal lines on the forehead, the vertical lines between the eyebrows, and the crow's feet. So that's kind of the eyes of the midline of the face. Anything above tends to be Botox. Anything below tends to be filler. A lot of exceptions to that. So I'll just kind of work my way down. When some people smile really big, you see a lot of upper gum.
Yep.
And so you could put Botox in a muscle, called your levator angularis. So when they smile, you can't see that.
Okay.
You can put Botox, kind of like when you're raising an eyebrow, you could do the same thing with the mouth. So you could paralyze a muscle called your DAO, depressor angularis. And so when I make this face, I'm pulling down the tail of the corners of my mouth. And so as we age, we kind of like, if you ever look at like a 56-year-old, their mouths kind of do that. So you can raise their corners of the mouth. A lot of people are doing the lip flip. So that just kind of everts or turns out the upper lip a little bit. It's kind of training wheels before you go on to dermal filler in the lips, like lip filler.
So would a filler on the upper lip do the same for a woman?
Yeah, Botox will do a little bit, but filler is really what they secretly want. They're just kind of too scared to do it initially. So they do the lip flip and then they're like, okay, that was good, but I'm ready for the next step.
From a male perspective, dating women and all that, I see women with all different lip sizes.
Yes.
I think a little filler is good, but often I see too much and I'm like, I'm not into it.
No.
Is that something they actually come in and they're like, yo, doc, line me up. I want to be blown up lips.
It's like anything. It's like moderation. A little bit of lip filler, wonderful. A lot of lip filler tends to be a problem, becomes very obvious, tends to not even stay in the lips, migrates above. It's just not a good look, you know, and it's like up to the provider, if they're ethical, to be like, you know what, you should stop. Mm. You know, you're looking weird and you're my billboard. You know, you're a reflection of my work and you're out there. People are going to think you look weird. People are going to ask where you did that. You're going to say, that's the Botox. You're like, never going there. You know, so I think I've said no to a lot of people. I've had a lot of people be like, if you don't do it, I'm going to go to somewhere else. And sometimes I'm like, got to keep the lights on. I'm like, okay. But oftentimes I'm like, you know, I just don't want to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I just think it's given this whole industry a bad name.
Yeah.
So it's like makeup. Like if you ask guys, a lot of guys, they're like, do you like women in makeup? And sometimes they'll be like, no, I like natural look. But honestly, it's because they're thinking of that one out of 30, 50, whatever women that obviously just like put way too much makeup. And so that's what they think every girl with makeup
is. I'm not big into the woman that wear like bright lipstick. I've never been into that.
Okay.
And I like just natural looking lips. And so I'm like, are there guys out there that are like, they're into women that wear these bright lipstick colors?
There's someone for everyone. Yeah. I think, you know, there's guys that are into that kind of like fake overdone look. It's cultural.
Okay. I got another question for you. So how about below the eyes? People get bags, especially as they age, or maybe they're tired. Does Botox cure that?
No. Remember I said eyes are the midline of the face. Anything above tends to be Botox. Anything below tends to be filler.
Oh, why is that? Because it's not a muscle down there?
Botox paralyzes muscles.
Okay.
And there's just the lower face, you don't want to paralyze your muscle. You don't want that, like, there's like I was kind of naming the exceptions, but you don't want to not be able to fully move your lower face.
Okay.
You know, if you smile and you don't move at all. You don't want that stroke victim, you know, like.
Yeah, yeah.
So it just kind of worked out that way. You could restrict the motion up here. It looks great. Down here,
not so much.
You really have to go to someone knowing what they're doing. Yeah.
Okay. Got it. That makes sense. Okay. So.
But what you're talking about, though, is tear troughs.
That's the eyebrow thing?
That's the hollowness underneath the eye.
Okay. Tear troughs. Got it.
Tear trough. Kind of if you're crying, the tear goes in that little trough.
Gotcha.
And that's done with dermal filler or a lot of people are using PRP, platelet-rich plasma, more natural approach. You have to do more treatments, but we take your own blood, centrifuge it down. There's a little fibrin plug in the tube on top. Or the red blood cells, toss those, then you have what's called platelet-rich plasma.
Okay.
That yellow gold on the bottom. And so we inject those into areas like that, and it's kind of like stimulates your body to make its own collagen and takes a little longer than fillers. It's not quite the instant gratification, but I think it's a nice approach for certain areas like that.
What's the most units that you've ever put on someone or injected in someone? If you love real estate investing, passive income, and tax benefits, but don't have the time, my company, Summers Capital, is buying boutique hotels right now. We source the deals, we renovate the properties, and we even handle all the day-to-day management, making it truly hands-off for our investors. If you want to learn more to see if we can help you, visit summerscapital.com/invest to book a call with our team. Again, that's summerscapital.com/invest. Now back to the show.
I would say it's not crazy. So I would probably say around 250.
250?
Mm-hmm.
Holy cow.
But it's like, what are you doing with 250? So everyone thinks when they think Botox, they think Botox cosmetic, but only 50% of Botox is cosmetic. The other 50% is therapeutic.
Really?
Yes. So
give an example of what therapeutic would, why
would
someone
we were talking about the face earlier.
Yeah.
There's a muscle called the masseter. So when we're chewing, like when you're clenching on your jaw, that's called the masseter.
Oh.
Like this muscle. And so A lot of people do Botox there cosmetically because you make the muscle smaller. So if your face is too square or round, it kind of makes it more heart-shaped, more tapered. But I would say a majority of patients, even at Estee Botox, which is a cosmetic practice that does not take insurance, a lot of patients are coming in for disorders on the TMJ spectrum. So nighttime teeth clenching, grinding, daytime teeth clenching, TMJ, headache, chronic pain. You inject Botox. A lot of people carry their stress here, like when their stress are just clenching. A lot of people do it in their traps. Their shoulders are up like this. So that's one application we use non-cosmetic Botox for. But then you have doctors that, they use it, like the urologist will do they'll put a scope in your bladder for certain spastic bladder disease, et cetera. They'll inject 300 units throughout the bladder. There's stories, there's little kids with cerebral palsy and they're spastic contracted. I mean, I remember hearing a story about a kid that was so contracted that his like fingernails were actually growing through his hand, because his hand was just in a fist and they cannot open it up.
Mm.
And so they use Botox in all the flexor muscles of the forearm and that relaxed that. So he wasn't like a return function to that muscle, but at least he was more comfortable. He wasn't in pain flexed, chronically for the rest of his life. Those guys are using these are little kids that weigh, 20, 30, 40 pounds, and they're using like 1,000 units kind of thing.
But this is a forearm, right?
This is a forearm. Yeah. If you think about the muscles in the forehead compared to the muscles of the forearm. Yeah.
So you can really inject Botox anywhere in the body if you wanted to really just kind of slow down the muscle.
Yep. People are doing it in the traps for stress. It's called Barbie Tox now. People are doing it in the calves.
Barbie Tox. Damn.
Some people feel, it's not my hang up, but some people feel like their calves are too big. They're putting Botox in their calves.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
These are women or men?
Mostly women, I would say. Yeah. I don't know
many men that are like, oh, my calves are too big.
I know. I don't, yeah.
But the woman, okay, I see a woman. Okay.
Yeah.
They want a little bit less. Okay. Where else? What's like the most unique spot part of the body?
Oh, they put it everywhere. I mean, the GI doc does a scope and he could if you have your sphincter connects your esophagus to your stomach is too tight and you have dysphagia, difficulty swallowing, they could inject Botox to open that up.
You guys do all that too? Or you only do
face stuff? You don't want me sticking
a
scope
down your
throat. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
These are very specialized docs, the GI guy, he went to residency for that.
Yeah.
The urologist. I'm not trying to put a scope in someone's bladder.
Will you do the calves though?
If someone asked me, make sure.
Yeah. Like that. Okay. So I've heard a lot of not a lot, but someone told me the other day, they say, hey, if you work out a lot, which I do work out, they say the Botox is going to wear off a lot quicker because you're working out, you're sweating. Is that true or false?
So I've never read an actual prospective study on that, but just anecdotally having done this for, 10 plus years. It's definitely my more active patients that I'm seeing closer to 2.5 months than my more, I wouldn't say sluggish, but I mean the less active people that I'm seeing less frequently. So I think in the most non-doctor way, just anecdotally, I feel yes, that is true.
Okay. And then timeline wise, I'm a weekend. Where would this peak for me in terms of the top of the frozen muscle
probably
cells?
At 10 days to 14.
10 to 14.
Yeah,
okay.
You're probably pretty close though because she did 84. Dose equals duration.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
So the number of units equals duration?
To a certain extent, and then it levels out.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But your more units will kick in sooner and will last longer.
Okay. Got it.
And then there's a point of diminished return, obviously. Again, just put 1,000 units here and think you're good for 5 years. But
it's not true.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's just say that I want to keep this steady year-round. How often should I be doing this?
So most patients do it about 3 or 4 times a year.
So every 3 months, do you think it's about right?
Yep. Okay. If you want to be one of those good patients that are on the ball and when you're starting to get a crow's foot or slightest sign of being able to furrow your brow, come back.
Yeah. And so you're saying after the peak, 2 weeks in, I'm going to start to feel it kind of slowly wear off?
It plateaus. I would say 10 days to 2 weeks, it plateaus. And then you'll feel the same for about 3 months.
Mm.
And then I think you'll begin to feel that taper. When it goes fast.
Okay. So I'll know when it's time. I already scheduled it with her. I'm like, before she left, I'm like, let's put it on the books. So she's coming back in 3 months.
Oh, I love that. I love patients like you guys.
Yeah.
Later.
And maybe I'll have to check out your shop too, man.
Yeah. I don't want to poach you from, sounds like you like your provider, but.
Yeah. So what is an alternative to Botox? Is there any new medicine out there that competes with it?
So Botox is in a class of drugs called neuromodulators.
Okay.
And there's five now. Botox is the household name.
Okay.
Everyone knows Botox. It's like the Kleenex. You know, like it's really tissue paper, but everyone calls it Kleenex. Pass the Kleenex. You have Botox, Dysport, Xeomin, Jeuveau, and Daxi. Honestly, they're all very similar, just different companies make them. They're all my children. You know, like we carry Botox and Dysport because they're the two industry leaders. But I don't have anything negative to say about the others either. It's just people don't come in and say, oh, I'd like to get Jeuveau. I mean, if they ever did, I would get some, but it's just they haven't really gotten that market.
And they all do the same thing. It's just different names.
They're very similar, like what we call the pharmacokinetics, like when they kick in, how long they last, all that kind of stuff, the cost, the number of needle sticks.
Yeah.
They're all very similar. But Botox is just what everyone wants. So it just, you know, it just makes life easy.
I didn't realize that Botox has been around since like, what, the 1980s?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Therapeutically.
Okay.
So cosmetically.
Since, how long has it been popular?
It's been like 25
okay.
years-ish.
Is there like ways to see like, okay, someone that takes Botox for 25 years, let's say they start when they're 35, now they're 60. This is what they look like if they took Botox regularly, and this is what they would look like if they didn't take it regularly. If you had like identical twins,
yeah.
You could probably do that.
Or yeah. if you could convince someone to do a split face study.
Just do one.
I'd be a tough sell, like 35 years of Botox on my right and not my left.
So yeah.
I think that famous photo of the truck driver. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's all over the internet. He like drove the same like route every day. And so window down, had sun on this side and not this side. And it was just like, you know, old man here and, you know, looking a little more youthful on the other side that was in the shade.
Yeah, that's crazy, dude.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I'll have to check it out. Yeah, man. I didn't realize it was preventative. And then once I did, you know, it's like all those things, right? You see something for the first time, maybe it's like a new car, and then all of a sudden you see that new car everywhere, right? It's in your mind. So the second I learned about
it. Oh, I get that all the time. Dude, like, someone will come in and they're like, I didn't realize all my friends have been doing this for, you know.
Yeah.
You should have heard we closed during early COVID, like everyone. There was a couple months there. And when we came back, you know, we're a medical office, so we came back a little, you know, like when medical offices could.
Yeah.
So it wasn't even that long. I had like 780 missed calls.
Damn.
Or voicemails. And they were like, my husband doesn't know I've been doing this for like 10 years. I need you guys to open. I'm looking old. Like, you know, like the funniest the funniest voicemails. I'm like, so we got those people in for sure. But yeah, it's definitely something that a lot of people do. And I think it's a little generational in that my older patients tend to not tell. They're kind of gatekeepers. Mm. They just kind of do it. And, you know, like they don't park under the giant sign. They kind of sneak in. And then the younger patients are going live on TikTok. It's like, I never thought I would see the day, but Botox has almost become cool. Like, I don't know. Like sometimes in my Pacific Beach office specifically, sometimes a patient will come in and I'm like, you really don't need Botox. Like, keep us in mind. Thank you. When you're not making the face, if you're not raising your eyebrows or furrowing your brow or smiling and you don't really have those lines, they completely 100% fade. Still too early. It's when you're not raising your eyebrows, but you still have a faint horizontal line on your forehead. That's a good time to come in because we could fade those. Whereas, you know, let's say the 60-year-old that's lived on a boat in Florida, I'm looking at my sad little syringe of Botox in their face. I'm going to do my best and we could fade them, but they're never going to be zero.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about is preventative Botox. And you're absolutely right. Like you're ahead of the curve on this. Like it is the younger generation gets it. They're doing it earlier and they're really never going to develop those lines that their parents or the previous generation had.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I'm a big fan of like investing in yourself, right? So whether it's like your own education, whether it's into like a nice pair of clothes, getting your teeth fixed, like all that sort of stuff, I'm big into it. Or maybe you want to get a nose job. And if that's going to give you more confidence, then you should go do it, you know? And so I'm a big fan of that, but also taking care of your body, whether it's like your health or Botox, preventative, I'm on camera, right? And like, I'm doing a lot of things to where I'm face to face and I want to age gracefully and I want to be able to do this game for another 30, 40, 50, 60 years, right? Luckily, I'm not an athlete and, you know, the game that I'm playing, real estate, I can play for another 40, 50 years, you know,
right.
But I got to take care of my health and I want to look good. So for me, it was a no-brainer.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I love what you just said. Like taking care of yourself is like getting more socially acceptable, especially for men. I've got another business called Center for Health and Wellbeing. It's concierge medicine, longevity medicine, and we take care of the inside. You know, I think the healthcare system is I'm not a fan of the healthcare system. I think the biggest problem is the insurance company. So middleman dictating your care. Like there's a saying, like, what do you learn in med school is a reimbursable medicine. And so I kind of like, you know what? This is a concierge practice. It's, you know, $500 a month. You have access to the doctor. You want to, you know, like unlimited access to the doctor. You call, we're going to get you in the next day. We're not going to make you sit there for an additional 45 minutes, an hour. We're not going to see you for 2 minutes because we got to be somewhere else and like see like 70 patients that day. I love your demographic, which is my demographic. I'm 41, you're 38, mm-hmm. but it's like the who goes to the doctor the least is men between the ages of 18 and 40 because, mm-hmm. you know, you have to go as a kid and then you're healthy. You don't have any problems. But then at 40s, little things start creeping in. So you're like, oh, insomnia, high blood pressure, whatever it is. And so that's, I really love collecting those. That's like our demographic is like us, people that are beginning to care about themselves. And we're early on, you know, you probably don't have any major medical problems. You don't have to tell anybody.
No.
But
luckily, knock on wood.
Exactly. Right? And I, you know, what's the best way of, is to take care of yourself is to not get those problems.
Yeah.
So I have another business called Weight Loss Shots. We sell Ozempic and all those weight loss medications that are huge right now. And I remember when they first came out, it was a diabetic medication. And then, you know, the Kardashians and everyone was taking them to lose weight and diabetics weren't able to get their own medication. We don't even get it from the big pharma. We get it from compounding pharmacies. So we don't take from diabetics. But I always made the argument that I wish that diabetic should have had that medication 10 years ago because diabetes starts 10 years before it becomes clinically apparent. And then you've reached a criteria of like what we call a hemoglobin A1C of 6.5 or above. But that started a long time ago. And the precursor was obesity and being overweight oftentimes, not always, but almost most times. And if they took that medication 10 years ago, they would have dealt with that obesity. They would have never developed the diabetes. And now they wouldn't have to be on semaglutide chronically for the rest of their life and probably three other diabetic medications. It's like a lot of things. I think the prevention of disease is just so important. I think that's the kind of medicine I want to practice. And that's, I know I kind of had this very non-traditional route of doing the anesthesia and then the aesthetics. It's kind of come a little back into... Like, I want to help people. I want to, like, I love helping them look good, but I want to help them be healthy. And this, for me, is like a new passion. It's like really kind of collecting people when they're just beginning to get things. So those issues never become major issues.
Yeah. I love that, dude. Because, you know, at 38, 39, I'm like, okay, well, all these things that I'm doing in my life and that a lot of us do to improve our lives, whether it's, you know, financially or our relationships with friends and family, spiritually, all these things that we do to improve our lives, none of that matters the second your health goes out the window.
Yep.
And so, you know, now I start to think about my longevity, my fitness. I always prioritize my fitness and, you know, what I'm putting in my body as well. So I start to think more and more about these things as I get older. So I love everything that you're talking about here. The Ozempic, is that what the Kardashians were taking?
I mean, I don't know if they ever officially, you know, coughed up to that.
But that was all the stuff in the tabloids.
Yeah, that's the tabloid.
And this is a lot of the... folks up in LA, Hollywood, this is what they're doing to kind of lose weight, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
And so what do you call your business? Your other one, it's One Shot?
Oh, it's called Weight Loss Shots.
Weight Loss Shop.
Yeah.
Okay. And you guys do the Ozempic?
Yes.
Okay, got it. Yep. So tell me about the Ozempic, pros and cons.
Oh, there's so many pros. I mean, so there are, the pro is that you're people that have struggled with weight their entire lives. They have this like food chatter, like all they, you know, it's kind of like hard to focus because they're always thinking about their next snack or meal or whatever.
Yeah.
It finally kind of turns that off. And so they're not chronically hungry. So it just makes, that's the mechanism of action. It just makes them less hungry and they eat less. Also slows down the gastric emptying. So the food as it goes through the GI tract goes through slower, which is does make them feel full longer, but that's where the side effects are. And it's really like... all GI related. So it can be nausea is probably number one. Every once in a while vomiting can be like heartburn, burpee, especially when you first start the medication. There could be lower GI stuff like diarrhea, constipation. Most patients, very mild, tolerable. Every once in a while, a patient is just, these things are just debilitating. So they don't. It's a drug. It's like a once in a generation drug. I really feel I'm passionate about this one. It really, because obesity is a huge problem. Something like 41% of Americans are overweight. Obese, I think. And So it's a really and obesity is obviously the precursor to so many other diseases. Like we were talking about diabetes, right. Metabolic disorder, heart disease, you know, high blood pressure. I could go on and on. So
to cure all that is a powerful thing.
It really does. I mean, literally today, this morning, I get emails from the American Medical Association, kind of like little blurbs on what to do in medicine. And the newest study showed that Ozempic decreased the incidence of multiple sclerosis by 80%, 75 or 80%, which is crazy because that's an autoimmune disease. You don't even think that it's like all the diseases I'm just talking about. I don't even know how that fits. I don't even know the mechanism of action, to be honest, on that one. But another one was these medications, they're called GLP-1 agonists, that they decrease the incidence of renal failure. So the day that study came out, DaVita, which is the biggest dialysis center in the United States, it's like, you know, everywhere, if you're on dialysis, chances are you go to DaVita to get it. Their stock, publicly traded company, went down 26%. So, I mean, it's really like, we're all kind of having diseases of hyperalimentation, eating too much. I'm not saying we're, and it's not, I think it's also destigmatizing being overweight because it was always like, oh, that person's, you know, I think there's a lot of stigma like that person's lazy, that person, whatever. And it's not. It's like they just have a different brain chemistry. They're just, there may be a component to that, but there is also a component of they're just this unfortunate population that just is always hungry. You know, evolutionarily, we weren't supposed to have food 3 times a day on demand. And that's just what we have, you know, in current society.
Especially with Uber Eats and Postmates and all these apps.
Yeah.
And love it or hate it, I actually love it because, you know, for me, time is money. It's a convenience thing. I probably eat Uber Eats probably 14 times a week, but it's amazing. Like, I don't do the meal prep stuff. It's like, dude, that requires work. I got to like order this stuff. I got to get these boxes and unpackage. I got to bring it in the office and microwave. I don't even have time for that. So for me, dude, I literally open up my phone. I click a couple buttons and literally I got 250 options, whatever I feel like eating, Asian food, Mexican, Thai, Greek, Italian, click a couple buttons and it shows up 15 minutes later and I just eat it and toss it. Dude, that is such a huge freaking thing for me. I love it.
Yeah.
Now, there's some healthy options on there, which I do love. I don't eat like McDonald's and Chick-fil-A every day, but dude, I love it.
Yeah.
But to your point,
I love it. Yeah.
To your point, I mean, today's age has probably never been a more challenging time to stay lean because you have all these distractions and all these food options at your disposal versus, you know, in the ancestor period where we had to go hunt for our food and you might not eat for 2 days.
Exactly.
That was normal.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, actually, like evolutionarily, I was thinking about that and I decided I was going to do a 7-day water fast.
Your biggest partner in a real estate deal is always your lender. For me, I prefer using someone I know, like, and trust. Whether you're looking for commercial loans, residential loans, bridge loans, DSCR loans, no debt to income ratio, no tax returns, my guy, Chris Groves, has got you. As seen on episode 77 and episode 142, Chris is a good friend of mine and is doing a special offer for podcast listeners, $2,500 off of your closing costs in or appraisal fees. Visit grovescapital.com/richdummers to book a free call. Again, it's grovescapital.com/richdummers to book a free call. Now back to the show.
And so I drank nothing but water for 7 days.
You
and I will
that?
Say
vitamins? Any like what did
no, just water. Like,
just straight water.
Yep.
No like, no sodium, nothing.
No sodium, nothing.
Fuck.
Yeah.
Did you almost die?
No. No, I felt it was weird. It's like I would say from hour say 20 to 40. I was miserable. I was hangry, you know, exactly what we all experience when we're hungry. But then you break through and you go kind of into ketogenesis. The body enters this elegant state of conservation. Like I could take food or not. I was thinking clearly. It wasn't terrible, but I think that's evolution right there. I think it's like what you said. We weren't, you know, like when are we going to get that next kill in that hunt? And where are we going to find some berries to forage, you know? So it's like, I don't recommend that. I'm not saying everyone should do that. It was something I did. It was interesting.
What did you feel on like day 4 and 5?
I felt good. Like, you know,
really?
I was maybe a little decreased energy, but overall mental clarity was sharp. You know,
how about sleep?
I think I was sleeping well. Can't remember. You know, it was weird. I mean, this might be TMI, but I just didn't poop because like nothing in, nothing out.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about that. You know, so it was like, I just didn't poop for 6 days, 7 days. And
damn.
Yeah.
And how about day 6, 7?
I mean, I think the physical fatigue got probably increased a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I know people that have gone longer.
Really?
I mean, I wasn't doing it for any disease. I was just for a particular disease. I mean, I was doing it for
just to cleanse your body.
Just to see, to see how my body would react, get to know myself a little better. You know,
damn, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Did you lose a lot of muscle?
I did. So, I wish I had done like a, you know, a body composition test before and after. I think the body does, when you go that extreme, I think the body does catabolize or break down muscle in addition to fat. Probably, I think I was down like 7 pounds, and I would, I mean, this is just me guessing, but probably like half and half, half fat, half muscle. I mean, I definitely had the top 4 abs, but I also, like, my arms didn't look as good.
That would have been interesting to see what percentage was fat burn versus muscle loss.
Yeah. Ozempic works similar, just you're not hungry, and so you eat less. It's not like it fixes everything. It definitely is a tool, and it's a very powerful tool, but you have to eat right when you do eat, and you have to exercise, because you're right, you would lose, like, no one wants to be skinny fat.
Yeah.
Everyone wants that nice lean look now. That's what I like, you know, and myself and
lean muscle. No, totally. So with Ozempic, can you still lift heavy weights and get a decent amount of protein in so you can actually still build lean muscle while you lose fat?
Yeah, absolutely. You just have to be a little more conscious of it. You have to be more purposeful with what you are consuming.
High protein diet, low calorie type of thing.
You know, like everyone knows you should eat after the workout, high protein. Yeah.
So you might drink a protein shake and be like, I'm not hungry anymore.
Yep.
And do things like not taste good?
Yeah, you know, when you're full and you...
Food just isn't
wonderful.
But when you're hungry, starving, everything tastes
everything.
Good.
Like, even if it's not that good, you're just like, so for sure, I would say when people first started and they go to a restaurant and they order, you know, they order like they normally do an appetizer, an entree, and then they see themselves eating like 2 potato skins and nothing else. I mean, it's a reset. And then you learn, and then you, like, you know, start sharing an entree or whatever that looks like. So I always tell people, like, we charge, I think, $300 a month to be on Ozempic or semaglutide.
Okay.
But it's like a joke, because it's like, do it for your health, do it for your aesthetics. You know, you'll feel good, you'll look better. And then, but do it for your finance, because, like, you're going to save probably more than $300 in food.
Mm.
You know, like, food's expensive. Like, a dozen eggs is what, like 10 bucks? I don't know.
Well, to take it a step further, you said do it for finance in terms of saving. But you could argue if you look good, you're going to feel good, you're going to have more confidence. And if you're in business, you'll probably make more money. Or if you're in a sales position, you might make more money because
totally.
Of it.
So taking care of yourself is so important.
Yeah.
You know, I think we could often get lost in our jobs. And I'm sure you're fascinated job. I'm fascinated by mine.
Yeah.
But we really have to take the time to self-care. You're talking about starting your Botox journey. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I consider that part of that. I think vanity and health are... they go hand in hand. When you're young, it tends to be a little more vanity. When you're old, it tends to be more health. Looking good is healthy, you know, and being healthy, you look good. So
yeah, totally.
Like, what the initial motivator is, I'm not sure, but they all kind of get to that same end point.
I haven't started the Ozempic journey yet, though. So we'll see about that one. So with the Ozempic, how often do you start to get diced up in dosage?
So it's a self-administered. You give yourself a shot. We teach you how, and you do it one time a week.
Right in the ass or what? Butt cheek?
You could do a sub Q. So you just kind of pinch your belly and you could do it right there, create a little wheel underneath the skin right there.
Once a week. And then how long should you be on it for?
Oh, that depends. So, I mean, like you look like you're in great shape. You probably, let's say you wanted to lose 10 pounds. Just, I don't think you need to, but you know, that didn't probably like, and men always lose weight so fast. It's crazy.
Really?
Yeah. It's just husbands.
Faster metabolisms.
Yeah. Muscle is a very metabolically active tissue. And so you always see like the husband wife try to lose weight, let's say January 1st, and like come end of February, the husband's down like 35 pounds and the wife's down like 5.
Yeah.
You know, it's not fair. But for someone, let's say they want to lose like 10 pounds, you know, then they might be on it for 2 months. If someone wants to lose, and then you have like someone who's 500 pounds or like, you know, like 400 or 500 pounds.
And so that might be a 2 year
thing.
Just
being honest, that's kind of like they're going to have to be on that for the rest of their life.
Mm.
That's going to be every
part of their routine. Because even if you get to a stable weight, you don't want to go back.
Right.
And so it's now at that point,
body,
it's preventative.
Their body wants to be at a set weight. And so.
Got it. You might taper down the dosage once they get to a ideal
And
a
the hope
weight.
Is too that they adopt some really healthy habits along their weight loss journey, as they call it. And so like that it is easier to maintain, you know, that they don't necessarily, and maybe let's say you're 400 or 500 pounds and you can't walk on a treadmill because all that weight on your knees, your bone on bone, osteoarthritis. So by losing that weight, hopefully it then allows you. Some people are so big they can't work out, you know?
Yeah. So with your company Weight Loss Shots, a patient could be anywhere in the country and they could order Ozempic from you?
Yes.
That's pretty badass.
It is cool. Yeah. So So when you're a doctor, you have to get every state license.
Okay.
You want to practice in. So it was, and they're not easy. They take a lot of work. I've got staff that just applies for state licenses and renews for me. But I have all 50 state licenses at this point.
So literally, just go to your website. Do you guys do like a virtual consultation and then you send it out?
Yep. So it's a virtual consultation. We do some lab work. We have relationships with, you know, Quest and LabCorp.
Mm.
You meet the nurse practitioner, she kind of goes over everything, or the doctor, and then we ship you the meds. We then have another virtual consultation where we teach you how, because the lay person, I forget, because I, you know, all day I'm just injecting people with Botox, but lay person doesn't know how to drop the medication. You don't want them doing like 10 times too much by accident, because that could be a rough couple weeks of their life. And so we teach them that, and then they kind of check in on them every couple of weeks and make sure they're progressing, see how they're doing, see if they're not having bad side effects.
Yeah.
All that kind
of
thing.
And you said it's only $300 a month, huh?
$300 a month, yeah.
Damn, that's a hell of a deal, man.
That's how I feel, yeah.
Yeah.
So the reason is because...
I mean, you can't even get a gym membership in some of these higher-end gyms for that number.
Oh, right, like Fit? What is that, like 150 now?
I'm a member of Fit. It's like, I think I pay like 110 a month.
Okay.
Compound, I'm 100, but like Lifetime? Lifetime's like $300-$400 a month.
Oh, that nice one in La Jolla?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
The Valley Parking and all the other...
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah, so the reason... So the pharmaceutical industry... is an interesting one, obviously. There's a company out of, it's a Danish company called Novo Nordisk, and they invented Ozempic, semaglutide. And what it is, it's a peptide that the body makes naturally, but they tweaked it so that instead of that peptide lasting 10, 15 minutes, it lasts the full week.
Mm.
And so it's more stable. And so they underestimated exactly how much the world is going to love this stuff. And so they can't make it fast enough. They're literally making like a giant factory in Europe to just crank this stuff. And as a result, it's under shortage. And so the compounding pharmacies, the little local guys can make it. And so they make it. And it's like many things. So this same drug, the one Ozempic, if you were to buy the name brand in Germany, it's $55. In Canada, a month. In Canada, it's $140 a month. And in the U.S., it's $1,400 a month.
Wow.
Just because that's what the market dictates, and that's what they can, and that's what they do. That's cost prohibitive for a lot of people. Like if you're going to pay out of pocket. And insurance companies, they go back and forth, because if they put everyone that is overweight on it, it would just like we had to pay $1,400 for every overweight person per month. I mean, it would just cripple the...
But then no one's going to have diabetes and all this other stuff anymore. And that's going to be a money loss for them, right? All the prescriptions
could
that they
be.
Sell.
Oh, it's like all pharmaceutical companies and insurance companies, obviously, like there aren't many super fans of these industries.
Yeah.
But yeah, like their incentives are in weird places.
You mentioned earlier in the show that you're not a big fan of the pharmaceutical industry here in America. Can you elaborate more on the reasons behind that?
I would say pharmaceutical. I do appreciate that they're the one, like, we drive innovation, even though Ozempic is... you know, comes from Novo Nordisk, a Danish company, but we do drive innovation. So I do see the benefit, you know, like I think we are supplementing the world a little bit, and that because we pay so much for our prescription meds and everyone else doesn't. So I think there's that, but.
What about insurance?
I do not love insurance.
Okay. So like, tell me some of the reasons why you're not a big fan of the insurance here in the US.
Oh, I just don't like that as a provider, there's many complaints, but they dictate care. They make, like, in order for doctors in traditional medicine, not what I do, which is, you know, like cosmetic cash based, but it's like in order to get paid from the insurance company, it's like 3 months later, it's, you know, 10 cents on the dollar. It's just, you need a full-time staff member, just the hound, Aetna and Blue Cross Blue Shield, all these companies. So that's the provider side. And I was privy to that for when I was, you know, working in the hospitals as an anesthesiologist. In order for the doctor to make money, let's say the family medicine doc, they have to cram in like 70 patients a day in order to, you know, just because of the reimbursement and the misery of it all. And then, so that's why that patient's sitting there for 45 minutes to see their doctor for 2 minutes, you know, because he's got to go, he's late because he's been seeing too many patients and he's got to go see too many more patients. And so it's just a broken system. I just think it's, you know, it's like if we went to dinner, like instead of us paying, like third party pays that we pay, it's just like doesn't make any sense. It's just,
yeah.
You know, I think insurance is important for catastrophic. If I leave here and I get in a car accident, you know, and I'm in the ICU for 2 months, please, insurance, yes. And I just.
But for the little stuff, it doesn't make sense.
Little stuff, yeah. Just like every doctor will see you and give you the time of day if you just pay it out of pocket and just like, yeah, it's just. I don't want to go too deep into all my philosophy on all that stuff, but it just doesn't make sense. It should be a free market. It should be a one payer system where the government pays for everyone because there's a safety net. And then it should be a free market where if I want to be seen tomorrow by this person, like I could pay in like anything else in life. I could make that happen. Like capitalism always wins. I hope I don't come off sounding crass or like an asshole, but capitalism always finds a way. Mm-hmm. Like the insurance company, the prime example. So they were making so much money and paying their executives and profit and all that, that the government, very well intended, said that the insurance company can only take home 15% of what they make, and 85% has to be paid off in claims. So then the insurance company then allowed hospitals and other clinics to start cranking their prices to crazy. If you go to the hospital and a Tylenol is like $400, and that's because the insurance company wanted the hospital to do that because then they can make 85% of a bigger number than, 85% of like a real Tylenol, which, whatever it used to be.
And the hospital wins too, because now they're making more money.
Oh, exactly. Like my kid had a little health scare when I was traveling. I ended up at Stanford. All we did was sit on their gurney in the ER. We did talk to the doctor, and I got a bill, separate bill, paid that right away.
Mm-hmm.
But the hospital ended up charging me like something like $6,000. And I have insurance. Granted, I get the bronze because I feel like I like to roll the dice, but
yeah.
I still had to pay $6,000, and literally like all they did was check us in, let us sit on the gurney. They never did a lab. They never did an X-ray. They put a pulse ox on her finger, that little, beep, beep thing. And I tried to argue, and they were like, I said, send me an itemized bill because I want to see what I was paying for.
Totally.
And they sent me to collections. And so I paid right away because I didn't want to mess my credit. Totally. I have the means, but like still, I was just kind of like, that's kind of what really set me off on this.
Dude, I agree with you, man. And in the insurance industry, like even folks that I know that are in the insurance game and they have companies and that's how they make their money, they don't talk about being in the insurance game. They never want to talk about it. But you got life insurance, that's a whole nother realm. And then property insurance, which we deal with, that's a whole nother ballgame. So residential deals, they abide by different rules, but in the commercial space, so you buy all these different assets, hotels, apartment buildings, retail, office, mobile home parks, all this stuff. The commercial real estate insurance providers, it's like the Wild West. So right now, insurance, they're not paying out. It's very, very challenging to get them to pay out on claims. We just had one of our hotels, four of the units got flooded out. We had record rainfall late January, and we filed an insurance claim and they denied our claim. I'm like, well, what the fuck are we paying insurance for? We pay $62,000 a year annual premium for that particular property. And the record rainfall, four rooms get flooded out due to it, and they don't pay out.
And it's what the fuck? What was their justification? What did they say?
They actually denied the claim without sending a rep out to the property, so without a site visit. And so we're actually reopening that case. We hired a public adjuster. Obviously for us, we had to keep moving. We got to renovate these units, so we're funding it with our own money, getting them back live, and then our public adjuster is now going after the accounts or after the insurance company to try to recoup what we can. My point is this: yes, it's tough to get these commercial real estate insurance providers to pay out, and their premiums just go up and up and up. I mean, premiums have really doubled in a lot of markets right now in the real estate game. And then when shit hits the fan, they find every single reason not to pay out. And if there really was like a black swan event, or let's just say there was a fucking something catastrophic, and everyone had claims, these companies, they don't have the money to pay.
They would be able to pay
them. They don't have the money.
Right.
At the end of the day, it's like, what are we really paying for? Lenders require it. But at the end of the day, push come to shove, it's hard to get someone to pay out anyways.
Oh, I'm glad you're passionate about not loving insurance. Obviously, I'm more on the medical side. You're more on the commercial.
Total.
Hopefully, we don't get murdered by like, insurance company. But I mean, I do think that it's just a dirty business all around. It's just like, I have an insurance claim right now on a Turo car that I had that, something happened to. And It's not like yours, certainly, but it's like they're incentivized to say no. And it's like, then I didn't crash it. The engine seized on me. So that's on me.
Yeah.
And I seized your engine. I'm the one that didn't change the oil or whatever.
All these insurance companies have adjusters on payroll, and their sole job is to find every reason to deny claims.
Yeah.
that's their sole job. So, I mean, think about it from a cash flow perspective. It's like everyone's paying monthly, and it's just cash coming in. And then when there is a claim, they just find a way not to pay it out. So it's like, it's kind of a crazy business.
Dirty.
It is very dirty.
Yeah.
Luckily now, like residential insurance, they abide by different rules. And so if you got like a single family property, something happens, you're very likely to get paid out because of it. But commercial space, it's the wild, wild west.
Really?
Yeah.
It's one of the few times I might say maybe we need a little more regulation. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'm usually on the other side of that. Like, California, leave me alone.
Yeah.
But
do you ever mess with the testosterone space? Because I think that's an industry that's blown up.
So I've got another business. It's called Optimize You.
Really?
And so we do hormone replacement.
No shit.
Okay. I would say I think we have over 1,000 patients at this point, and I would say 80% of them are men.
Okay.
Women tend to be a little more complicated. You know, there's pre, post, perimenopausal. You know, men, it's like testosterone. You know, it's always like the answer. They're always super happy.
What are women looking for? Like more estrogen or what's a
common estrogen thing? Progesterone, testosterone. Like testosterone is actually, there is more testosterone in a woman's body than estrogen.
Really?
And no one knows that. They're different units the way they're come up on labs. There's still way more testosterone in men, obviously, like 10x, but still that is the number one hormone in women.
What is a normal testosterone level for a woman?
Oh, of course.
What's a normal range?
To be honest, I don't know.
Okay.
Day to day on the office.
I know men's like 400 to 800 is considered
men are
normal?
Yep. 400 to 1100, I think are the.
Even 1100. Wow. Mm,
oh yeah. Oftentimes you put a guy and it's not just the number. It's
guys
like
will have 1100 naturally.
Rarely.
Yeah.
Lucky guys.
That's crazy.
Crazy. Like, especially buddies, younger guys.
Yeah. Cause I got buddies that are on it. And they, you know, like once a week and they're like, but low level, like 900, just to be at 900. But ironically, I feel like a lot of my friends that work out, they're healthy, they have muscle mass, they go in and get tested at these clinics and then their results come back really low, like 350.
Yep.
And then they get on it and all of a sudden they're up to like 800 or 900.
And they feel great. Yeah.
They feel great.
It's not just the number. The number is important. It's also the symptomatology.
What does that mean?
So if like a guy comes in, he's 500. Let's say two guys come in, both 500. But one guy is complaining about decreased libido, decreased energy, like going to the gym, not getting any gains. Just like we're more likely to put him on it than the other guy at 500 that he's feeling okay. He's just kind of dabbling. He's just shopping around, seeing what it's all about. It's all about the number and the symptomatology. Because everyone's different. Biology is not 500 in me is not 500 in you. You know, I could have more, my receptor could just be better at, you know, binding that testosterone I have. Yours is weaker or vice versa.
Got it.
So a little more nuance to it, but there is, I just started taking testosterone myself. I'm a fan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were your levels before and then what are they now?
So I haven't gotten tested because I've only been on it for about a month, but before I was like in my mid 400s.
Got it. And so how do you feel?
I feel good. I feel great. Like I honestly, like I'm walking around. Chest is a little higher. Like I go to the gym. I'm seeing some gains even this early. I have more energy. To be honest, I'm married. So like, I think my increased libido is kind of bothering my wife, but you know, I don't think that's going to last forever. So,
She doesn't like that part of it, huh?
I thought she does.
I thought women love that.
I mean,
part.
I'm just like hammering nails right now. It's like, I like it. I just wish I would calm down a little bit.
Okay.
And I could tweak my dose a little bit too. And I don't think that's going to be what it's going to be like the rest of my life. I think it's just, you know, kind of that initial ramp up time.
Yeah. Yeah. What was holding you back from getting started? I mean, you're 41. What was holding you back from getting started?
I think I didn't need it. I felt pretty good. And then I started to decrease the energy. And I tried it at around your age at 38. And I didn't see that big a jump in energy level and the way I felt. So I just kind of stopped. Now, you know, it's 95% good, kind of like Ozempic, but there are downsides to testosterone. I mean, it does cause you to lose your hair faster. It's a male pattern baldness. So I'm on testosterone to raise my testosterone. And then I'm on Propecia, finasteride, which prevents the conversion of testosterone to dihydrotestosterone, DHT. The DHT is what's on the hair follicle. So that's what binds the receptor. So that's what binds the hair follicle and makes us lose our hair. So I'm trying to get the benefit without the downside. Some guys can't tolerate Propecia or finasteride because it can decrease your libido or even your ability to get an erection. So I've not had that side effect yet. If I do, I will stop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's other little things. You know, if you have prostate cancer, which we check for, it can increase the growth of that prostate cancer, testosterone. So we have to be careful. That's why it's a good idea to go somewhere reputable. and actually get lab work done as opposed to going to your gym.
You don't even know where you're taking
the dude with the duffel bag in the back,
in the locker room.
Yeah, like really make sure that you don't have an issue before you get on it. So the reason cyclists abuse testosterone is not because of increased muscle. It's because increased oxygen carrying capacity. It increased your red blood cell, your hemoglobin, hematocrit. And so they could carry more oxygen. So they're endurance athletes. They could go further. But you can increase your hemoglobin hematocrit too high where your blood becomes thicker or more viscous. And so that can lead to, you know, strokes and heart attacks and bad things. Again, you want to get tested every couple of months just to make sure your hemoglobin hematocrit isn't too high. And if it is, you have to go do a therapeutic phlebotomy. You have to go donate blood, basically.
Yeah.
That decreases that. And
I got a question. So, you know, I'm not on test right now. I'm 38, but it's in the cards for me in the future. Like right now, I have good energy just naturally. I'm seeing gains at the gym, but I know at some point, probably in my 40s, I will definitely start it. Because a lot of my friends are like, dude, once you start, you're on it forever.
Kinda, yeah. Well, you don't have to be, but you want to be, yeah.
Yeah. My question for you, though, is like, you know, I like to go out and enjoy a glass of wine, have a little wine every now and then. Is that getting on testosterone, can you still go out and enjoy some drinks, or is that a lot more of a load on your liver?
No, to be honest, testosterone is not a very big load on the liver. The way the liver works is when you eat something, it goes into your portal vein, absorbed through your GI tract into your portal vein, and it goes to your liver. So it's called first pass, you know, when you absorb something by eating. So testosterone is given through an injection. So it kind of bypasses.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I wouldn't be overly concerned.
About unless that. You're,
like, and no one's really on the oral testosterone anymore. That's stuff that people used to do back in like, no. I don't know, 80s, 90s.
It's all injected now.
It's
right?
all injected now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's not a concern.
So yeah, live your life.
Yeah, it's good to know, man. Okay. And so you guys have offices all over for the testosterone?
We have three offices in San Diego.
Where's the closest to here?
Hillcrest.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, Fifth Avenue kind of. I don't even know the other street, but.
So you just go in once a week?
No. I mean, you go in and we kind of like the Ozempic. We ship you the vial and you learn how to do it. You can go in once a week.
Got it.
But I think the better dosing is two times a week so you don't have the peak and the trough. And I think it's just, even if you're terrified of needles, like the misery of having to drive somewhere once or twice a week is the inconvenience. Like you get over your needle phobia pretty quick.
When it's like anything, you do it a handful of times and you're over it.
So yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. I mean, I live in this world. I forget that everyone doesn't just come so naturally to them, but it's a quick learning curve. It's not that hard. Or if you're really like one of those needle phobic people, I mean, get your wife or girlfriend or whoever, roommate, they can inject you.
Yeah. I love it too. Well, Alex, I appreciate you coming on the show, man, and hanging out. This is the third podcast today, man. I was like most excited for this one. So it's been good. You know, like I said, I got the Botox going. At some point I'll get on that testosterone and, you know, I don't know if I'm ready for Ozempic yet, but we'll see. Where can the folks get in touch with you?
SDBotox.com is probably my main. I would say my personal passion, it's got my Instagram is right here. It's Dr. Alex Knows Best. DR for doctor and nose is NOSE because I specialize in liquid nose jobs. We'll have to talk about that some other time.
What is a liquid nose job?
So I use filler to make the nose straighter. And
really?
So a traditional surgical rhinoplasty, they have a little hammer and chisel, ting ting, they break that little bone cartilage right there. And so like all of medicine, is moving a little away from invasive to minimally invasive. So what I do, like this little bump in the nose, that's called the dorsal hump.
Okay.
And so we fill above and below to decrease that. And we could also raise the tip. We can also, if someone has, we do a lot of, even post-surgical patients, they love their nose, but there's a little, you could tweak it. So that's kind of become my passion within SD Botox. My business is within
really?
My business, but.
No black eyes with this procedure.
No. So there's upsides and downsides. Like there's no general anesthesia. There's no, you know, $15,000, $20,000 price tag. There's no month of two black eyes. There's no kind of wide bridge for 6 months to a year. Downside, it's not permanent. We use a filler called Juvederm Volux. It lasts 2 years. You know, like you have to go to someone that really knows what they're doing. It can be a sketchy area to inject. It's the most satisfying thing because a patient will walk into the office and instant gratification. I show them a mirror afterwards and their nose is straight and like, this is like a splinter in their brain since childhood. And now they're crying and they're hugging me. And it's just like
they're one stoked.
Of those. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. I love that procedure. So
yeah, everyone comes in. They're probably stoked, right? I mean, you're making them feel better.
Guys give me hugs. Nose patients.
Yeah. I love it, dude.
Yeah, I always joke like traditional medicine is kind of all you're trying to do is get back to baseline. You were here and you got sick. Now we want to get you there. Now you need surgery. We'll get you there. But everyone's coming to us because they want to be a little bit better for a little way, even if it's something small, even if it's Botox. It's just like a little tweak and they feel better about themselves. You know, it's just a fun, like they come in and like you're surrounded by happy people, you know, not everyone all the time, obviously, but like, let's say 98% of people, you know, traditional medicine is just like, you're kind of surrounded by sick and dying people, which is super important. I mean, thank you. It's like someone take care of me when I'm sick and dying and God bless you for what you do. But I just love what I do. You know, I'm just happy to be with all these happy people.
Yeah, absolutely, man. It's a beautiful thing. I love it. Well, dude, appreciate you coming on, man. And I'm going to definitely have to hit you up when I'm ready for that testosterone train. So we'll see. But thank you, my man. He's Dr. Alex Roher. I'm Rich Summers. Listeners, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you in the next one. Peace.